A pair of filmmakers from Florida have explored the history of the Vietnam War from an interesting perspective. Surfing.
The only veteran I know that signed up for a second tour in Vietnam so he could surf the big waves.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we follow the journey back to China Beach. We'll also hear about the Army's new recruiting campaign, learn how students can find success by finding their edge, and spend an academic minute writing the old-fashioned way. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The TV series China Beach debuted in 1988 and ran for 4 seasons. The real China Beach has been around a whole lot longer. Now, a pair of filmmakers from Florida have created a documentary about the history of the Vietnam War from the perspective of the soldiers who surfed that famous stretch of sand. Here to talk about the film is director Dave Barnes and producer and longtime surfer Mike Cotton. I asked Mike what drew them to China Beach.
Back in 1965, I was growing up in South Florida, young surfer, and a friend of mine came back. I had been wounded in Vietnam, but he told me that it was beautiful. They had surf. Other than getting shot at occasionally, it wasn't too bad. So I've been fascinated with this whole story my entire life. And I met Dave about 10 years ago. We were working on a TV show together, and I kept telling Dave about this story. And about 3.5 years ago, we decided we were going to move forward with this.
You know, China Beach became the place where they could get away from the war, get away from the pressure, get away from all that. And it became the vacation spot, for lack of a better term, in Vietnam. And I thought that was very fascinating that they had a place to go.
When people hear the name China Beach, all of a sudden Dana Delaney comes into their head. Did you guys have any preconceived notions going in?
I did not, because I never watched the show very much. And now Larry in town here was involved in that show. He's one of the guys that helped us with the movie. So he had some ideas, but I know nothing about it.
Larry Martin, who is a Pensacola local, actually ended up having 2 tours there. He's the only veteran I know that signed up for a second tour in Vietnam so he could surf the big waves the next season. But he was really the one, not the first, but he was early on getting the China Beach Surf Club organized and helping with all that. And when the combatants would come out of the jungles and so forth, he would help them get to the beach, surf if they could surf. But just, I think, being at that beach and the water.
Decompress.
Yeah, it psychologically. It really, and I've been surfing now over 55 years. To go back to Larry for a moment, Larry was very important that I got him on board because I had heard about him, that he lived in Pensacola, and he was the first main consultant to the TV show China Beach. China Beach, the TV show, used veterans as consultants to the show to try to get it accurate. But it took me a while, and I think his wife maybe helped me out a little bit, and she just said, Larry, these guys are ready to do this on their dime and tell your story, so you need to help them. But Larry today is part of the family, and he just had so much knowledge and so many connections. And he is Mr. China Beach, a lot of people call him.
When you were doing your research, who were some of the characters that made you think, boy, this is going to be a great story?
Well, there's a number of people that came that we interviewed. And the more we started to interview people, the more stories came out. A lot of these guys had not talked about their Vietnam experience at all. One of my favorite stories is when the helicopter landed on China Beach and blew cement, dirt, and dust over everybody because they had to get this kid out of the jungle. And they told the kid, it was actually Marines that brought him in. They said, tell him it's an Army helicopter as they threw the kid out. So the Army got in trouble for it.
You know, this is not a typical war story, and there's been some great ones out there. But, you know, this is a whole different take on the Vietnam War. And I always tell people it's a film of hope and healing. And it does have a happy ending because we followed these fellas and some gals as well, their lives till now. And then we took a film crew about a year ago back to Vietnam to China Beach, which is really called My Key Beach. It's at Da Nang. China Beach is really a nickname that our military personnel gave that, since it's on the South China Sea.
And today it's all condominiums and very, very
hotels.
Developed.
isn't every beach condominium and hotels.
Yeah.
Who did you take with you? Did you take any veterans with you?
We met a fellow originally from Texas, but he lives in Oklahoma. His name is Ronnie Ratliff. And Ronnie went over to heal himself, couldn't get much help from the VA in 98. And he ended up staying there 3 years and marrying a lady. And then when he came back, he started taking groups of vets over there. And this was his 22nd trip back. We were the first non-veteran group. But it gave us an inside track on everything. So we didn't really have to think too much. We just told him what we wanted to capture, and he set everything up for us. And his story became very important in this film of the problems that he had and how today he feels so much better going back there. And, of course, the Vietnamese people are actually beautiful people, at least the ones that we met. And
it was great experience.
Yeah.
For a communist country, you would never know it. I mean, it was very commercial. People were selling stuff everywhere. Total freedom. So it was a very interesting trip.
Right.
How free were you allowed to film?
Totally. There was only one time where we had a couple of guys watching us, and they were dressed like civilians. And I said, come on over. And I let them look through the camera, and they got all excited. And they walked away.
I told them we were having a family reunion. And then I acted like a crazy tourist, and the one guy shook his head and walked away. And Ronnie about fell on the ground laughing. He says, you'll never see those guys again. And by the way, those were secret police. Yeah. But, you know, they're going to love this film when we take it back there, because it's all positive. But, you know, as creative people, we definitely didn't need the government over there to tell us how to make this film. We knew what we had to get.
Reaction to the film, both from veterans and non-veterans.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Really positive.
Yeah, we did the world premiere. Was at the Pensacola Little Theater November 24th. Once that film ended, and Dave and I knew the one demographic we had to please was the Vietnam veterans, because if they thought this was, you know, BS, then we were going to put it in the shoebox and forget about it. But the theater was weird. It went kind of quiet, and then some people started clapping, and then they started cheering. Veterans.
And a lot of people crying.
Yeah.
A lot of these guys.
Tears.
Going,
a lot of tears.
Going back.
And those Vietnam veterans saying, you know, we know what happened. This is the most accurate depiction that we've seen. And then their families are going, now it all makes sense, because they've been hearing these stories in a lot of cases.
You were over there. Did you get in the water?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, went surfing. In fact, Pat Schultz, a dear friend of ours, helped us on our other two documentaries. She's the former United States champ from 78. In her 60s, she still is a magnificent surfer. So we got a couple of days. There was a couple of days Dave wouldn't let us go out because we were busy filming. It was killing us. The waves were great. But, yeah, we went out there, and that was great. And we met, you know, as the saying goes now, Charlie does surf, you know, from Apocalypse Now. They said, Charlie, don't know Charlie does surf now.
Mike Cotton is the producer of the new documentary, Back to China Beach. Dave Barnes is the director. You can find a trailer to the film on YouTube, and we'll link to that from the Best of Our Knowledge page at WAMC.org. The armed forces have been looking for fresh new ways to attract young people since the dawn of the all-volunteer force. Now there's a new marketing campaign called What's Your Warrior, which was launched in November. Its goal is to turn students into recruits, and it's short on crawling in the mud and long on high tech. Dan Boyce reports for the American Homefront Project.
Recruiting company commander Josh Trenkel has been touring brand new recruits around Fort Carson Army Base in Colorado Springs. They stopped by a shooting simulator, peeked inside military vehicles. Now Trenkel announces it's lunchtime.
Enjoying a wonderful gourmet MRE. That's a meal ready to eat.
Hey, you need a water.
Soldiers hand out the brown plastic packages at random. Recruit Crystal Townsend, sitting cross-legged on the grass, she's peering into her MRE sack. She got a vegetable crumble. Townsend is 35, on the older end for a recruit.
When I was younger, when I was 18, 19, I did want to join, but I wasn't really confident in myself. I didn't know anybody in the military, and I wasn't really sure I could do it.
She ended up in law enforcement, a deputy sheriff, a stable job, a professional career. Still, as she got older and closer to the maximum age for enlistment.
Looking back and having those regrets, it was just eating at me, and I finally said, you know what, I'm going to go for it.
Other recruits are just out of high school, looking for that classic Army experience as a gunner or an infantryman. I speak with one woman looking to go into communications. Another man is aiming to jumpstart his career as a firefighter. The range of ambitions these recruits have is exactly how the Army is hoping to sell itself to the next generation of service members. The new Army marketing campaign is called What's Your Warrior? And the first ad looks more like a trailer for an effects-laden superhero movie than a traditional recruitment pitch. Helicopters flying through mountain passes, a woman at a computer terminal communicates with a satellite overhead, a scientist is hard at work splitting microscopic cells.
There's this idea amongst lots of youth and perhaps even parents that there's only one way to serve, and that's in a combat role.
Brigadier General Alex Fink is the chief of Army Enterprise Marketing. He's behind What's Your Warrior. Fink says military marketing that focuses on the glory of battle just isn't working like in the past, especially as fewer and fewer Americans have family military legacies to live up to.
It's really more about surprising our audience about what you can do in the Army.
So the emphasis in What's Your Warrior is on showing the variety of career fields and the real-world benefits of service. The Army says the initial figures for this campaign have been pretty good. What's Your Warrior debuted in November, and Brigadier General Fink says the number of people filling out reply forms on GoArmy.com has jumped 35% over last year. But that's just the first step.
It's great and fine and dandy to fill out a business reply card online, but how does that translate into actually getting folks to make a commitment? So we'll see.
You guys want to fire again? Because
we can bring. And that's where the individual relationship between recruit and recruiter comes in. Colorado Springs company commander Josh Trankel says his recruiters are using the new What's Your Warrior campaign to start the conversation.
That's where the art of it is. They really need to know how to take that message and give it to the students coming out of school these days and make sure that they know the opportunities that are available to them.
For new recruit Crystal Townsend, eating her vegetable crumble on that Fort Carson tour, the logical path would be to move from her job as a sheriff's deputy to military police. Instead, she's looking at something completely different.
My number one pick is military intelligence. I would figure it'd be a waste of opportunity to not go into something else, challenge myself by learning a completely new field.
She says the diversity of career options led her to choosing the Army over another military branch. If What's Your Warrior works, a lot more people will be taking a look at those options too. In Colorado Springs, I'm Dan Boyce.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Still to come, for students to find success, they need to have an edge. We'll explore that theory next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. What does it take for a student to find success? According to Laura Huang, it takes an elusive quality she calls an edge. Dr. Huang is an associate professor at Harvard Business School. In her debut book called Edge, Turning Adversity into Advantage, she draws from her research showing that personal success takes more than our ideas, credentials, skills, and hard work. It takes an edge. Laura Huang spoke with The Best of Our Knowledge's Elizabeth Hill on how students can tap into their edge.
So I guess I'd just like to start with the difference between inherent advantages and created advantages and
yeah.
how they ultimately frame a person's success.
The notion that I talk about is that some people naturally have an advantage. It could be because they belong to the right groups or the right networks, or they look a certain way or have a certain education. And other people in different situations, we might find ourselves where we don't naturally have an advantage. But we can create an advantage for ourselves. When we recognize that success and outcomes are sort of dictated by perceptions and signals and cues and stereotypes, we have also in our power the ability to flip those stereotypes and challenges and obstacles in our favor so that we can find and create our own advantage.
And your book discusses the importance of hard work, but going beyond hard work What factors should we be emphasizing to students and children to help them find their edge?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of different things there. I think, you know, even from a young age, we're sort of taught that hard work is the secret to success, right? You ask super successful people, people who are seen as at the top of their game, CEOs and venture capitalists and Olympic medal holders, and you ask them, you know, how did you achieve this success? And inevitably, they'll mention hard work. And, you know, hard work is absolutely critical, but the thing is that we realize at a certain point that hard work alone is not enough, that there are outcomes and successes that are being determined by lots of other things. And this sort of myth of meritocracy, once we come to terms with that and understand that, that's when we can sort of empower ourselves to do something about it. In terms of children, a lot of times what I see is parents trying so hard to give their kids an advantage, right? We see, for instance, parents who are trying to buy even their kids' ways into universities, paying illegally for SAT scores and getting their kids into colleges and universities. But on a more benign level, we also see parents, for instance, you know, trying to give their kids an advantage through extra tutoring or private coaches or exposure to extracurricular activities. And instead of trying so hard to give their kids an advantage, what I talk a lot about is teaching your kids instead to create their own advantage, teaching them to create their own edge so that they can go into any situation, any circumstance, and know the ways in which they provide value and know how to change those negative perceptions that others may have of them.
In your book, you talk about a variety of different people and how they overcame what was perceived to be a disadvantage for them and turned it on its head to make it an advantage for them. Can you discuss some of these people that you have highlighted in your book and how they overcame their disadvantages?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I talk about the traditional, you know, the normal cast of characters that we typically think about when we think about disadvantage, but it's not just that typical cast of characters of gender, race, ethnicity, class, religion, sexual orientation, those types of things. There's certainly disadvantages when it comes to those traits or those attributes. But as I talk a lot about in the book, everyone has something. We walk into a room, and as soon as we walk into a new situation, we're being judged, we're being perceived, and there's people are making attributions about us. So, for example, one could be ageism, right? We could be interviewing for a job, or we could be trying to get a promotion or in an organization, and we're being judged as being too old or employees that are, you know, washed up and too old for progressing with the company. And so I talk about how do you think about the sorts of perceptions? And one of the first things that people sort of acknowledge is that understanding those perceptions that others have of us. In the case of ageism or in the case of older employees, it's understanding that the perception, while the lay perceptions may be things like they're not as technically skilled or they're not able to learn technology as quickly, the perception, honestly, the underlying perception is things like a lack of curiosity or a lack of wanting to understand and being curious about what the company is doing. And so in those instances, when I have older employees going into job interviews and I tell them before interviewing, I say things like, the perception that they have of you is that you're not curious. So give them examples about how you're curious about what they're doing, about their strategy. And in those interview situations, when they then go in saying things like, you know, tell me more about how you came to this strategy or came to this vision for this organization, or I'm curious about why you're doing it in this way. Not only are they just as likely to get that job, in many instances, they're more likely to get the job. And not only are they able to flip those perceptions as being seen as someone who's curious and able to help them evolve with the company, they also are seen as being curious about technologically new advances and all sorts of things that come along with those negative perceptions that they may have been attributed with to begin with.
I thought the story, the first-time politician candidate who overcame doubts about his physical disability, was interesting. Can you go into that?
Yeah, so Cyrus Habib is lieutenant governor of the state of Washington, and he's a man who is legally blind. He lost his eyesight when he was a child, and I talk about sort of his story and how he had to overcome adversity in not only running for office, but in terms of all sorts of different facets of his life. And, you know, a lot of times we have perceptions of certain people, and when he was telling me his story, what he realized was that a lot of the perceptions were about concern, about, you know, caring for him and concern, you know. So he had friends who would say to him, "You can't run for office. Do you know how physically tiring that's going to be for you? Do you know how emotionally draining that's going to be for you? You're going to have to canvass and go house to house to house." And he talks about how he really had to guide people to what he was able to do and guide people's perceptions. And he would walk with them. He would walk with them and physically be guiding them as he was guiding their perceptions. The book is about gaining an edge, but it's really based on this framework that I've developed through my research, where the EDGE actually stands for the components, the framework itself, which Cyrus Habib, as well as many of the protagonists that I talk about in the book, really applied in gaining their edge. The E is for enrich, knowing how you enrich and provide value. And Cyrus knew that he really could provide value, that he could do this great service, that he could do this job. He knew what his superpowers were. The E is for enrich and knowing how you provide that value. The problem is that you often don't have that opportunity to show others how you enrich and provide value, just as Cyrus Habib and others have not been able to. And so the D is for delight. When you're able to delight someone, that's the equivalent of cracking that door open so that you can then show them how you enrich and provide value. The G is for guide. You need to be guiding people's perceptions, not just of who you are and who your what your traits are, but also the trajectory that you're taking, the things that you're able to do, the possibilities that you're able to present. And the final E is for effort and hard work. And as I sort of spoke about before, the hard work is something that we think comes first. That if you put in that hard work, if you're someone like Cyrus Habib, who has always put in that hard work, that it'll speak for itself. But in fact, we know that it doesn't speak for itself. And when you know how you enrich and delight and guide, that's when your effort and hard work actually works harder for you.
How has your approach benefited you and your success personally?
I think everyone has adversity and obstacles that sort of they face, and I'm no exception. You know, I think that certainly I've been very, very lucky, and a lot of the adversity doesn't just pales in comparison to some that others have had to face. But, you know, my mother is a single mother. You know, I had to work more than 20 hours a week as I was working my way through college, in addition to grants and scholarships and that sort of thing. But I also talk a lot about the early adversity that I faced, things that I faced as a child, being the child of immigrants, and how I had to really try and understand the ways in which I enrich and could delight others and guide those sort of perceptions. And something that I say a lot is that, you know, it's so important to be able to understand the situations that make us sort of bitter, that we hold on to because we feel like we face that adversity, but also how those situations make us better. And so to be thinking about how does this make me better, not bitter? And I think that's really something that I've learned throughout the course of my life that I talk a lot about in the book, and how that sort of does lead you to be able to gain these intuitions about who you are and what in what situations you're going to be perceived in one way versus another. All of that goes into really gaining and finding your edge. You know, I think one thing that I sometimes hear from people is that this aspect of flipping perceptions in your favor or flipping stereotypes and biases to work in your favor, that it almost feels like it's something strategic or manipulative even. And the thing is, what I tell people is that it's actually the opposite of that. What you're really doing is you're guiding people to who you authentically are. That people are going to be trying to write stories about who you are. In their head, they're going to be already telling stories about who you are and where you've been and what you're like. And it's actually a much more authentic, real thing. It's the opposite of being strategic or manipulative when you guide them to who you really are. That's when you're able to have deeper, richer interpersonal interactions with others.
Again, the name of Laura Huang's new book is Edge, Turning Adversity into Advantage. It's published by Penguin Random House. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Elizabeth Hill. Believe it or not, there are still writers who go nowhere near a keyboard while they're doing their thing. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Not everything has to be written digitally. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Joyce Kincaid, distinguished professor in the Department of English at Utah State University, examines bringing the slow movement to writing.
Noted actor Emma Thompson calls herself a Luddite because she writes longhand with a fountain pen. Actually, she may be in the vanguard of a cultural shift that I'm calling slow writing. Part of a larger movement that includes slow food, slow travel, and slow fashion. What characterizes slow writing? First, the material culture of writing, pens, ink, paper. Even if Hemingway didn't truly use a moleskin notebook, millions of devotees prefer this option to digital note-taking. And research shows that writing by hand enhances learning. The increasingly popular bullet journal offers an embellished to-do list. A manual on letter writing advises, a handwritten note is like dining by candlelight instead of flicking on the lights. Send your epistles by escargot, snail mail, savoring the choice of paper and stamp. Slow writing also involves ethical choices. Disposable pens are just that, disposable. Americans discard 1.6 billion pens annually. Using handmade paper from Nepal supports a 1,500-year-old tradition and also helps earthquake victims. A Thai elephant sanctuary funds itself through the sale of poo-poo paper. Writing is tied to its origins in communication with the gods. This notion of writing as sacred may have dimmed, but it's never gone away entirely. As the manufacturer of exclusive pens advertises, refill your soul by writing.
That was Joyce Kincaid of Utah State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.